Hello everyone. Welcome to the 12th episode of the series of podcasts with the IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Mohammad Mustafa Hussein, a professor of electrical engineering and computer science of University of California, Berkeley. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest today is one of the pioneers of the field microelectromechanical systems, or MEMS. He is a member of United States National Academy of Engineering, Professor Kensel Wise. Kensel David Wise received the BSEE degree with highest distinction from Purdue University in June 1963, and the MS and PhD degrees in electrical engineering from Stanford University in August 1964 and June 1969, respectively. From 1963 to 1965, and then on leave 1965 to 1969, he was a member of technical staff at Bell Telephone Laboratories, Murray Hill, New Jersey, where his work focused on the exploratory development of integrated electronics for use in thin-film magnetic memory stores. From 1965 to 1972, he was a research assistant and then a research associate and lecturer at Stanford, working on the development of micromachined silicon neural probes, pressure sensors, and wafer-level gas chromatography systems. These projects were seminal in launching the field now known as the microelectromechanical systems, or MEMS. His doctoral thesis reported the first lithographically formed microelectrode arrays for extracellular neural recording. In 1972, he returned to Bell Labs, Naperville, Illinois, to work on microcomputer-controlled telephone switching systems. And in 1974, he joined the faculty of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where he is now the William Gold Dow Distinguished University Professor Emeritus of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science, Professor Emeritus of Biomedical Engineering, and Professor Emeritus of Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Sciences. At the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, his work has focused on integrated sensors and microsystems, including piezo-resistive and capacitive pressure sensors for catheter tip applications, implantable extracellular neural microelectrode arrays, miniature integrated gas chromatography systems, uncooled infrared detectors and imagers, microflow meters, thin film gas detectors, inkjet print heads, drug delivery probes for use at the cellular level, and cochlear electrode arrays. He led programs funded by the NINDS Neural Prosthesis Program from 1981 until 2007, developing high-density microelectrode arrays for neuroscience and neural prostheses that helped launch programs such as the United States Brain Initiative. He directed the National Science Foundation Engineering Research Center for Wireless Integrated Microsystems from 2000 until 2010, pioneering microsystems for biomedical and environmental applications. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, although, you know, like most people, it'll be nice to get this pandemic behind us. Most of the university these days is virtual, and it's almost like a forced retirement. Even though I officially retired and became emeritus in 2011, but I'm still involved in a few research programs up there. So,
yeah. I think, like, you know, that we are seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. Just a few hours back, the CDC director, she actually allowed the people who are fully vaccinated, they will be able to go unmasked with the people who are also vaccinated in a small gathering. We'll see how it goes, but I think, like, you know, that from next year, we'll be in much better shape.
Let's hope so.
So I'll start from the very beginning. If you can kindly share some of your fond memories from your childhood, your school life, like, you know, the anything that, you know, any regret that you had, something like that.
Well, I was an only child, first of all, and I grew up in Michigan City, Indiana, which at that time was about 20,000 people in a kind of a resort town on Lake Michigan. My dad worked in Chicago and commuted in there by rail. It was a good place to grow up. I enjoyed it. And I had a lot of really good teachers that helped along the way. But I enjoyed growing up there. I worked very hard in school. I wanted to do well, I guess mainly partly because I was an only child. And so it took a lot of long hours, but I have no regrets about that.
Well, you know, that growing up in a resort town and being only child sometimes, like, you know, the can give a sense of security and comfort, which could have derailed, like, you know, many people to work hard. But, you know, that you decided to work hard from the very beginning, right? So I think that eventually gave us today's Ken Weiss. name justifies it all.
Well, perhaps, yes. I did work hard, and I worked hard when I went to undergraduate school. I went to Purdue, and my 4 years at Purdue, aside from summers and occasional trips home, it was a lot of work. And I was in a special R&D program that was shared between electrical engineering and physics. And I think all of us worked hard in that program, but I think by and large, it paid off well.
Very well. I think I would like to ask you this question then, because, you know, that you were working hard, like, on the from the very beginning, and I'm sure that you could have chosen any other different topic, any other different field, but, you know, that it seems like that your passion ignited for electron devices, the broader electron devices. Then you took MEMS, pioneered, you know, played the role of the one of the pioneers, and, like, you know, that in a sense personified that. So my question is that, what really ignited your passion for electron devices?
I think the passion for electron devices, it came out of a number of things. You know, I got my undergraduate degree in 1963, and there were actually two things that were hot then. One of them was microelectronics, because microelectronics was pretty new. The other one was magnetohydrodynamics, ion rockets. And I, sometime along in there, probably about 1962, I saw a magazine article that had flies crawling on top of chips, and there were forecasts that, you know, eventually you could get all the innards of a TV set on something the size of your fingernail. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, that'd be really neat. That would be fun to do and would have tremendous impact. And so that was one of the things, I guess, that started me on electron devices and integrated circuits. And I guess I've never been sorry that I went for that instead of ion rockets.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, that's quite a contrasting, like, you know, the thought process and perspective, because, you know, in the 40s, before the Second World War, as well as, like, you know, the kind of after the Second World War, there was, you know, anything big, right? Like, you know, the automobiles, the steel factories, or, you know, the rocket. So they were like, you know, the fascinating. But then there was a trend gradually and silently, like, you know, that came through, which is essentially about what is really small, how small can something be? But eventually we actually have figured out that we need the small things to build the bigger things, right? So I think, like, you know, that's the way it just all played out. So you talked about your undergraduate life. So how was your graduate life? Like, you know, the research and everything.
Well, I think at the graduate level, I remember going into one of my physics professors at Purdue and informing him that I was going to go to Stanford. And he said, oh my gosh, you're going to get out there with all those electronic nuts and you're going to get killed. And that didn't help my confidence level very much. But as I was graduating from Purdue, I interviewed with Bell Labs and was offered a position at Murray Hill. And I took that and I went there and I worked on peripheral electronics, really, for thin film magnetic memories. This was back in 1963. And, you know, I enjoyed that. I was there for a year. Actually, they sent me to Stanford. They had a 1 year on campus master's degree program. And that was the first year they had had that program at Stanford. And so five of us went out there and then I went back to Murray Hill for a year. And then Murray Hill decided that they weren't going to hire any more members of technical staff without a PhD. And I've always kind of been grateful to my boss back there, Tudor Finch, for suggesting that, hey, I might want to go back and get the doctorate, which is what I did. I went back in 65 and started a doctorate. Once I got the coursework out of the way, life was a little bit more relaxed. I met my wife, Joanne, in 1968 out there while I was doing my PhD. And we used to take delightful summer or Saturday trips all over the Bay Area, just exploring. And that was fun. The first year that I was there, I spent working on a program in integrated circuit reliability. Now, I was fascinated by integrated circuits and integrated circuit fabrication and trying to do new things with that. I think my advisor, Jim Angel, knew that. He'd been at Stanford 5 years and all of his work had been done on integrated circuit reliability. But as I got into it, I didn't see anything I could do with the reliability, especially of analog circuits, which was what I was working on. And he took mercy on me, I guess, and put me on a project that they were talking about to try to use the lithography techniques. It was a takeoff on some of the work at Murray Hill back then in what they called air-isolated integrated circuits or beam-lead integrated circuits. And I went to work trying to figure out how to use that technology to make arrays of electrodes that could be used extracellularly in the brain to monitor neural activity. And that's what I wound up doing for my PhD. So that's kind of the graduate life out there was very nice. It was a great place to be young and single and dating and yet we all worked hard and, it was fun getting to know some of the people that had, you know, done such important work at Bell Labs and elsewhere on the faculty out there too. So I've always been grateful for that experience.
Fantastic. You mentioned about that your first job then was in Bell Labs, right, in 1963. So apart from the fact that your manager was very generous, and I think, like, you know, he made the right, like, you know, the suggestion to you so that you pursued your PhD. And eventually that's where the global community, they became benefited because of your work, like, you know, on the electrodes and the understanding. I think that was the first brain machine interface, that today we see many work, but that's where it all started. And today it's the gold standard. So anything particular, any memory with that job, in Bell Labs?
Yeah, aside from summer jobs, the Bell Labs one was the probably the first. And it was, I enjoyed what I did. I reinvented the wheel a number of times that first year. And I was also taking classes at Bell Labs. But I think in the summer of 1966, I went back there just before I started the neural interface project. And the goal was really to learn some of their beam lead technology, which was being done by Marty Lepselder back there. It wasn't in our department, but I used to spend lunch hours going up and talking to some of the people up there. I think that summer, I got a chance. My assignment that summer was to work on a multi-channel readout chip for the memory stores that they were developing in our group. And that was a merge of Bell Labs thin film technology. They had a thin film technology based on tantalum and tantalum oxide for passives, for capacitors and for resistors. It was very stable and they were very committed to it. So this was a 10 channel readout chip. And by chip, I mean ceramic with tantalum on it. And then beam lead integrated circuit, or not integrated circuits, integrated transistors, beam leaded transistors that were stuck down all over it. But I really enjoyed that opportunity of doing something that initially my department wasn't sure could be done, and doing that to try to make a contribution. And later on, that was a paper at ISSCC. I think probably 1967. I was not an author, but I did all the masks for that project. So that was kind of where I really got into fabrication and using lithographic techniques to make things that were new.
Right. When I started my graduate life in University of Southern California, I was so fascinated with the MEMS technology because I took the course on the associated device fabrication. Mm-hmm. And then when I realized, I realized that the creative ideas, the process integration sequence, the way that those drawings, at that point, it was all two-dimensional, right? Just the cross-sectional drawing. Yeah. But then, this complex, you can say that at a micro scale machineries that they were fabricated and then they were integrated with the circuitry. So it was very fascinating. Eventually, when I became the integration person, I pretty much read every single paper they were published in GMMs. And all of you that they contributed, they helped me a lot to grow up, and to do the integration that way that I can do today. I learned a lot, and thanks for that. So when you were working on these, the micro needles and this kind of the brain machine interface. So what was was there any eureka moment that, yes, that's when you actually thought that, no, I have to look at it from this perspective, and then that became the game changer.
Probably the eureka moment came a little bit later. When I was at Stanford, we did neural probes and we showed that they could work. The technology then was not quite ready. Silicon etching was still in its infancy. It was all wet etching. And it was just about as hard to make the second probe as it was to make the first probe. But the idea from the beginning was you could make many electrodes on one substrate and you'd know what the relative positions of those electrode recording sites were. And so you could get a much better idea of what was going on in the neural circuitry. I stayed there after I graduated 3 years as a postdoc and as a lecturer. And we did pressure sensors, and we did started work on a wafer level gas chromatography system. I think those three programs were really seminal to starting what later became MEMS. I think Eureka moments probably came at one of them came at Michigan. When you were still etching the silicon from the backside, and you were trying to define something that was maybe 15 or 20 microns wide, it was very difficult to control. And you were doing two-sided wafer processing, and the yield was low, and I didn't want to do that anymore. We had another program in pressure sensors where we had started using what was called a boron etch stop. But if you put enough boron in the silicon lattice, it wouldn't dissolve in some of these etchants anymore.
Correct.
That was the Eureka moment, because all of a sudden we could make these devices from with a single-sided process on wafers of normal thickness. And it was marvelous. All you had to do when you got done with the process was throw them in a bucket of ethylene diamine and go to lunch and come back and fish them out. That was a Eureka moment. And we used variations on that process for a long time for pressure sensors and for all kinds of things. So that was one Eureka moment.
Yes, I think boron etch stop layer electron that has been a great asset, the tool for the CMOS, the folks. I have used it at a personal level, for making the flexible silicon, and we eventually patented this. This has been a great technology, right? Understanding and one of the interesting facts about all this is that someone needs to know about the material, the implantation, the diffusion physics, right? All the etch process, the chemistry, normally when we show all those, the cross-sectional views, people might think that, that they're showing just one film and then another mask and they're gone. But every single detail, they are precious. And, I always encourage the students today's learn fabrication really well, then a lot of things are far more easier. So when you were working in Michigan, right, I believe that while working on this, that you work with Khalil, he's a great friend and a mentor, right, for me, you had many students who work with you. So any interesting memories that comes to your mind all the time?
I think there are many memories. I guess I'm proudest of a lot of the people that I worked with. I mean, it was always a team effort. And I have many memories of Khalil when he was doing his thesis. That was almost a eureka moment in the sense that he was getting ready to give a paper at ISSCC, and it was 1986, and I think he was sicker than a dog, and he was working up in the lab to try to get pictures. It was the first time we had integrated signal processing circuitry on one of these probes, and at that time Michigan's fabrication facilities were not exactly what you would call stellar. He worked on that. He worked on it right through about a flu, I think. But he got those done. And I still value those SEM pictures as much as anything that we ever produced since that time. We went through many generations of on-chip circuitry and off-chip circuitry. But so many of the students really gave everything they had to getting the results that we did. And, you know, we had a great set of students and staff and faculty, and it was a joy to work with all of them. I think I'm proudest of the teams we had than any individual accomplishment, but certainly Khalil's first on-chip 10-channel EDNMOS circuitry, that was one of them.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, that the great advisors, they're always reflected through their great students, right? Like, you know, whatever they do, eventually it goes back to you. And yeah, so definitely those are like, you know, the great memories. You have worked on many different things, and like, you know, the brain machine interfacing, the neural electrodes, they are fantastic. Is there, like, you know, the, if you are being asked, like, you know, to pick, like, you know, the one or two more, what are those going to be? What are those are the works that you are very proud of? I'm sure that you are proud of all of your work, but I'm just saying that you really feel like, you know, that, yes, I was very happy. I was delighted. I was, like, you know, that excited.
Well, you always like to have your work go somewhere. And I think the neural interface work was a very good program, which we had for 25 years coming out of NINDS at NIH. That was a great program. It was run by Terry Hambrecht and Bill Hedertsen. And we had the ability there to go and if we needed a neuroanatomist or an electrochemist or anything, that program was really one for all and all for one. You could just call somebody up and they'd help. The other program a little later on that we had that I thought was outstanding was the NSF Engineering Research Centers program. That one was in wireless integrated microsystems, and essentially it was the front end of the internet of everything that we work on today. Lynn Preston directed that, and I thought that was also a terrific program. I think the pressure sensor work was one of the first things that we did that opened up electronic vehicles to electronic engine control. When I went to Michigan, there'd been a meeting someplace, and one of the faculty came back and said they decided that there was no place for electronics under the hood of a car. Turned out that wasn't very good. That wasn't right. Today we're you know, moving towards self-driving things. I think that one of the programs that started way back at Stanford, the one with the wafer level or chip scale gas chromatography, is going to be very big. I think that one, for both applications in healthcare and also for applications in environmental monitoring and all kinds of things, that one is going to come into its own also. And there are so many others that, you know, I could look at. One of my colleagues at Michigan now has been working on using microfluidics to monitor, basically to capture individual cells, and then to be able to test those cells in cocktails of various drugs to see what is effective in wiping out particular types of cancer on an individual by individual basis. I think things like that are going to be absolutely tremendous. So, you know, the neural stuff kind of helped start the U.S. Brain Initiative and other programs all around the world. I think that the pressure sensor work helped in terms of many applications and control. And the GC work and others of similar type are going to have tremendous impacts in the future. So, I mean, all of those things, I think, have been fun to do. And they've helped bridge microelectronics into areas that I think address additional global problems in terms of quality of life.
Yeah, definitely. I think the area of MEMS, that was kind of like, you know, today's IoT is nothing different than what, like, you know, the MEMS innovations they were back in the 90s, right? So there is not that much of difference. It's just that, you know, that as you say, right, that the wireless integration, the Bluetooth, you know, bringing all these in one single chip, or at least in one system in package, that is what's happening today. What we see from the innovation perspective, all these startups and, like, you know, the. So you mentioned about that, like, you know, the having the, you would like to see the microfluidics based bioassay for cancer detection, and potentially also, like, you know, that as much as curative and preventive measure, there is also, like, you know, the. That there are different things happening in the world of electronics, and more personally, like, you know, that I feel that reaching out to the communities who are not using electronics, the industries, and how we can help them to expand what we do. What do you think about the future of the electronics? Like, you know, that you are very excited about that, and if you can elaborate it further.
Yeah, I'll be happy to elaborate. I mean, I think electronics, you know, we started out, and you can't argue with the tremendous progress that's been made in control systems and information storage, and I see all of that continuing to get better and better. It may be that scaling is reaching some limits, but new devices are going to come along. I think we're going to continue to see progress at the device level. But I think the thing that is probably most exciting to me is seeing electronics continue to proliferate into almost every aspect of our lives. I mean, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the automobile was a mechanical device, pretty much pure and simple. It was mechanics. Today, it's an electronic device. That's where all the new innovations are coming from. That's what's happening. But I think if you look at all the problems we confront, whether they're in terms of infrastructure or environment or whatever, I think we'll see electronics pervade those disciplines. Almost anywhere there are problems that we need to solve, there are things that we need to do better. I think electronics is going to be there. And that this branching out is the thing that to me is exciting, because it's very easy to say, well, wow, you know, look at how far we've come. When I started working on magnetic memory at Bell Labs back in the 60s, we were trying to break a penny a bit. That's what we were trying to break, penny a bit. Now it's like a nanocent a bit, and they're non-volatile. And it's, you know, no one would have foreseen that, I think, 50 years ago. But I suspect that if you could go ahead another 20 or 30 years and look backwards, they're going to look back at us as having been really just on the leading edge of what's going to happen. So I think, you know, as far as we've come today, I think we've got a lot further to go. I think the technology is going to pervade all kinds of things, many of which we probably can't even envision today. But that's going to be exciting, and it's going to be fun. So, you know, as I said earlier, I've never been sorry that I chose microelectronics instead of magnetohydrodynamics.
Definitely. I think, like, you know, that this world of enthusiasm and excitements, they are going to excite the new generation more and more. I can see that they come up with ideas And whenever possible, I just like, you know, tell them that, you know, that just come back with a great hardware, and that you will see. If we didn't have this, like, you know, the touchscreen handheld smartphones, you know, that it would not have been possible to have Uber, Lyft, Instacart, like, you know, the DoorDash or any of this, right? Like, you know, so that's where the hardware innovation is very critical to keep the progress ongoing. And this is like, you know, that we are still scratching the surface. When I look at the 3D and IC or like, you know, the, those kind of architecture as well as the integration complexity, the more the complex, the more the challenge, the more the opportunities, let's put it this way. Okay, you mentioned about like, you know, the applications that we are not thinking of at the moment. And it's absolutely right. 15 years back, people didn't think about social media. And now today, social media controls pretty much everyone's life, whoever has a handheld device. So is there any particular application that you would like to see in future, like, you know, that you feel that it's, that does not exist today, but you would like to see it happening?
I think there are many areas that you know, you can kind of look at and say, well, how can electronics be taken advantage of to do these kinds of functions? To me, I think certainly healthcare is one of the big ones. We've made some inroads in healthcare, but there are a lot of things there that the technology is going to revolutionize. It hasn't happened yet. People are thinking about it, but it hasn't happened yet. Environmental issues, I think, are another one that I think are going to see a lot of application. Embedding electronics in infrastructure as it's made, whether it's roads or buildings or what have you, to kind of take the health of, monitor the health of structures, I think is going to be important. I mean, so many things that today, a few things have been done, but the progress and I think the promise of those areas is still mostly to come. So I think electronics is going to be just virtually everywhere. And, you know, as we define those applications, we're going to have to solve more problems along the way. But I think as we do that, we're going to improve the quality of life. And I hope that's certainly what happens.
Right. Fully agree. Right. Like, you know, that this, the upcoming infrastructure expenditure, I'm pretty sure that if we go for this smart village, smart like cities where IoT integrated, like, you know, the infrastructure is going to be highly beneficial, that, you know, that we didn't only go to the moon, we actually invented vacuum cleaner also, right? So that's how I will put it this way, right? So I'm pretty sure that, like, you know, the, as you're emphasizing that today's automobile, how many electronics they have, we can see the crisis. Like, you know, everyone is saying the auto industry that, you know, that we are suffering or we are like, you know, facing the limitations with the supply chain from the automobile related chips. But the truth is that there will be more and more chips in the automobiles and sure, with the healthcare, with monitoring and obviously robotics, right? Like, you know, the everywhere, you, let's put it this way, as you are, you know, like, you know, stressing. In that regard, I would like to actually ask you this question, that is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today? It can be technological, it can be non-technological, right? Like, you know, that you see something that which you feel that no, it should have been better, or it can be better.
Well, I think the things I've mentioned all can be better. We're kind of on the front end of applications and in things like environment and in things like monitoring people that are getting elderly, like some of us. You know, being able to monitor certain conditions remotely and essentially improve the quality of life. I think we're just scratching the surface on a lot of these things. So I would say, again, whether it's infrastructure or environmental or healthcare transportation or something else, I think in all of these areas, we're going to see terrific progress over the next 20 years. And, you know, sometimes you look at how far we've come and you say, gee, you know, running out of gas. I mean, you can't go any further. Well, in narrow areas, yeah, maybe, but over the broad scheme of things, we ain't seen nothing yet.
Right, right. 100%. Dr. Wise played a significant role in developing the field of MEMS, serving as guest editor of the IEEE Transactions on Electron Devices, special issues on solid-state sensors, actuators, and interface electronics, December 1979 and January 1982, and of the proceedings of the IEEE, August 1998. He was associate editor for solid-state sensors of the IEEE Transactions on Electron Devices, 1981 to 1985. He was the organizer and general chair of the 1984 IEEE Solid State Sensor Conference, Hilton Head, program chair of the 1985 IEEE International Conference on Solid State Sensors and Actuators, and general chair of the later conference in 1997, Transducers 97. He has given invited plenary papers on integrated sensors and microsystems at many conferences, including the IEEE International Electron Devices Meeting 1996 and 2006, the IEEE International Conference on Sensors, Actuators, and Microsystems 1983 and 2009, the IEEE Device Research Conference 2012, and the Solid State Sensor, Actuator, and Microsystems Conference, Hilton Head 1984 and 2012. Some of the selected awards for Dr. Kensel Wise include, but not limited to, Outstanding Paper Award, International Solid State Circuit Conference in 1971, NASA Certificate of Recognition for Creative Development of Technology, 1974, Distinguished Service Award, the University of Michigan, for mid-career faculty who have demonstrated remarkable contributions to the university, 1978, Outstanding Paper Award, International Solid State Conference, 1979, elected fellow of the IEEE for leadership in the field of integrated solid state sensors and engineering education, 1986, Beatrice Wiener Award for Editorial Excellence, International Solid State Circuits Conference, 1986, NASA Certificate of Recognition for the Innovative Development of Technology, 1987, Research Excellence Award, University of Michigan College of Engineering for demonstrated sustained excellence in research and related scholarly activities, 1987. Roger A. Haken, Best Student Paper Award with S.T. Cho in IEEE International Electron Devices Meeting, 1989. Paul Rappaport Award, IEEE Electron Devices Society, 1990. Stephen S. Atwood Award, University of Michigan College of Engineering, for extraordinary achievement in teaching, research, service, and other activities that have brought distinction to the college and university, 1992, named the J. Reed and Polly Anderson Professor of Manufacturing Technology, 1993, Distinguished Faculty Achievement Award, the University of Michigan, in 1995, elected fellow, American Institute of Medical and Biological Engineering for contributions and leadership in the development of integrated biomedical sensors, 1996. Winner of the Columbus Prize for an individual American who has improved or is attempting to improve the world through ingenuity and innovation, presented at Disney World in connection with the Discover Magazine Awards for Technical Innovation in 1996. Aristotle Award from the Semiconductor Research Corporation for deep commitment to the educational experience for students, emphasizing student advising and teaching through research, 1997. Elected to the National Academy of Engineering of the United States of America for Sensors and Microelectromechanical Systems, 1998. IEEE Solid State Circuits Technical Field Award for pioneering contributions to the development of solid state sensor circuits and integrated sensing systems, 1999. Named the William Gold Dow Distinguished University Professor of University of Michigan, 2002. Michigan Emerging Industry Pioneer Award in recognition of outstanding leadership to the MEMS, Microsystems and Nanotechnology Communities, 2005. Roger A. Haken Best Student Paper Award with Jay Wang, IEEE International Electron Devices Meeting, 2005. Named Purdue University Outstanding Electrical and Computer Engineer, 2006. Henry Russell Lectureship, University of Michigan, the university's highest honor for a senior member of its active faculty, 2007. University of Michigan Technology Transfer Career Achievement Award, 2010. University of Michigan Distinguished University Innovator Award with Khalil Nazafi, 2011. The University of Michigan College of Engineering establishes the WISE Nazafi Prize for Engineering Excellence in the Miniature World and recognition of pioneering work in the field of microelectromechanical systems by Kenzel D. Wise and Khalil Nazafi for many decades, 2018. So Ken, I will switch, you know, that our conversation to a little bit like, you know, the lighthearted mode. And this is very popular segment with our younger, the like, you know, the audience. And this is, we call like rapid round, rapid fire round, but it's kind of like, you know, we say that like, you know, they try to answer in one or two words, but, you know, we cannot restrict. So you can use as many words as you need. So whenever you're ready, okay?
Okay. Bear in mind that I'm a faculty member, and answering in one or two words be very difficult.
Yes, definitely. We do understand that part. Okay. What are your hobbies?
I enjoy photography. I enjoy writing, a little bit of woodworking, and history. I'm a history buff. If I could have done anything else, probably I would have been a historian.
Very good. The time has not gone yet. Okay. Music or movie? Which one you enjoy more?
I enjoy both. I used to joke that I used to play with the Chicago Symphony. Okay. Actually, when I was in high school, members of the Chicago Symphony used to come over and play with our local orchestra, local symphony. And that was a terrific experience. I like music, classical music, but I also like movies, both.
Okay, very good. The classical music, and how about the movie? Which genre of movie you like the more? You like more?
I like classical music, and I also like the pop music from the 50s through the 80s. Okay. Everybody likes what they grew up with. movies kind of the same way.
Okay, very good. What book you are reading now?
I'm rereading Crystal Fire, okay, which is really the book on the development of the information age. I've also enjoyed the one on Bob Noyce, the man that made the microchip.
Right.
That's a good book.
Very good. What is your favorite cuisine?
I don't think I have one. Chinese, Italian, American.
Okay. Any sports you enjoy?
Used to play tennis. These days I watch basketball and baseball and football. It's better if Detroit has a good team. So I haven't watched a lot of that lately.
Okay. What is your favorite travel spot?
Oh, I've been all over. I enjoy Europe. I did a couple sabbaticals there. But I've also enjoyed New Zealand and Australia and Japan. The cultures are very fascinating.
Definitely. Okay, so pretty much at the end of our conversation. What is your one piece of advice for the younger generation?
I would say work on something that is exciting and that you think will make a big impact on the world we live in. Have a mission to really make a difference. I think that's really important. And do something that you think is really neat.
Okay, I have a question regarding this. So if the younger generation come back to you and ask that, you know, that we do not have enough experience, right? Then how do we really identify that this is something is going to make a huge impact? Like, how you will guide them?
I think that everybody, as they come through, comes through at kind of a different time, and different things are going to be hot. And I think you have to just feel it. If you look at it and you think this is really neat and this is going to make an impact, a positive impact on things, that's good enough reason to go after it.
Very good. Okay, Ken, this question is not listed, but I will ask, I have asked others also. Was there anything that I did not ask you, but you want to talk about?
No, I don't think so. You've let me reminisce all the way from Bell Labs to current, pretty much. I think we've covered the waterfront pretty well. With me, I was lucky. I mean, I had a lot of good people along the way that kind of stepped in and helped at the right times. And I hope I've done the same for others that have come after me. And I think that's really what's important.
It's just needless to say. That's how I will put it, right? Like, you know, that you have impacted so many. Your work has reached out to people, that has helped people tangibly. Like, and you know, many people who have become academic, many of us, but how many of us have made that kind of sustained contributions to the society remains as an elusive challenge. But I would say that for anyone to decipher that, and that's why we are having these conversations where people, luminaries like yourself, are like in the candidly sharing, like, you know, that how you became today's Ken Wise. And I think, like, you know, that's fantastic. It was a great opportunity for me to have this conversation with you. And thank you for your time, Ken.
You're very kind, Mohammed. Thank you for your comments. I hope
no problem.
I hope people will look at this and take away that, you know, there's a lot of great missions ahead out there. And I hope the future is as much fun as the past has been.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.